Blog Talk Radio.
Had an interesting talk with him,
And I've invited them back on the show for next week. I haven't heard yet if he'll be on, but I look forward to possibly him being on next Thursday night, and we can for the entire show, so we can discuss his book in detail. And I wanted to perhaps I should read the preface, right? Because that explains. His gives you some a bit of his personality, and gives you the reason for his writing this book. And before I do that, let me just read the flap here. Vincent Bugliosi, whom many view as the nation's foremost prosecutor, has successfully taken on in court or on the pages of his books the most notorious murderers of the last half century. Charles Manson, O.J. Simpson, and Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, in the most controversial book of his celebrated career, he turns his incomparable prosecutorial eye on the greatest target of all, God. In making his case for agnosticism, Bugliosi has very arguably written the most powerful indictment ever of God, organized religion, theism, and atheism. Theists will be left reeling by the commanding nature of Bugliosi's extraordinary arguments against them. And with his trademark incisive logic and devastating wit, he exposes the intellectual poverty of atheism and skewers its leaders, popularizers, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and Richard Dawson. And joining a 2,000-year-old conversation which no one has contributed anything significant to for years, Bugliosi, in addition to destroying the all-important Christian argument of intelligent design, remarkably, yes, scarily, shakes the very foundations of Christianity by establishing that Jesus was not born of a virgin, and hence was not the Son of God. And the Scripture is, in reality, supports the notion of no free will, and that the immortality of the soul was a pure invention of Plato that Judaism and Christianity were forced to embrace, because without it, there is no life after death. And destined to be an all-time classic, Bugliosi's Divinity of Doubt sets a new course amid the explosion of best-selling books on atheism and theism, the middle path of agnosticism. In recognizing the limits of that we know, what we know, Bugliosi demonstrates that agnosticism is the most intelligent and responsible position to take on the eternal question of God's existence. And I enjoy that. It was written by the editor, I'm sure, but by the publisher. It's on the book's jacket. But I think this will explain more of it as we get along here. My view, this is the preface. My view is that sometimes it's nice to know a little bit about an author whose work you're about to read beyond the biography on the inside of the book's jacket, at least insofar as it relates to the book you are going to read. Other than the fact that I am a very hard worker and am able to draw sensible inferences from simple realities, what qualifies me, if anything, to go outside of my field of the law and weigh in on the biggest mystery of all, the question of God's existence. I do have to say that whatever abilities I may have as a traveler, I fortunately found easily transferable to my dealing with the arguments for and against the belief in God's existence, mainly objectively analyzing the various issues, then marshaling the evidence in support of my position and exposing what I perceive to be the weakness of the opposing side. But apart from what I have found, that at least in my professional life, I go through a private life blindfolded. I seem to naturally, and not as a result, I can assure you, of any special intelligence at all, see what's in front of me completely uninfluenced by the trappings of reputation, hoopla, conventional wisdom, and so on, and put it and put on it by others. Let me test you, the reader, with a hypothetical question so that you can see where you are on this issue. If you were told that Winston Churchill said something about World War II, and a bum in a Bowery gutter said something quite the opposite, who would you believe? There's only one answer to that question, and it's not that the one that 99% of the people would reflexively give, Winston Churchill. The only proper answer to the question is, I'd have to hear what they had to say. This is obviously true, since we know that just as a wise man can say something foolish, a fool can say something wise. Now, if neither Churchill nor the bum had weighed in on the issue yet, and you were asked who is more likely to say something intelligent about the matter, the obvious answer would be Churchill. What we're talking about here is the fact that most people see what they expect to see, and they want to see what conventional wisdom tells them to see. So, not what is right in front of them in its pristine condition. Put another way, they hear only the music, not the lyrics of human events. The only reason I mention this phenomenon is that in the book you are about to read, I will in many instances be taking a position different from what many people have expected to read or would prefer to read or what conventional wisdom tells them they should believe. And I feel that you, the reader, may be more receptive to the arguments I make and the inferences I draw in this book if you can make a conscious effort to avoid this common intellectual trap. In learning that I was writing a book about God and religion, more than one person asked me why I was writing the book, questioning what could he say, what could be said that hasn't already been said. The question has a certain amount of merit to it. After all, I'm joining a 2,000-year-old conversation. What can I possibly bring to the table? But let me tell you this about me. I never write anything for public consumption or appear on any radio or TV show unless I feel I have something to say that is not being said. For example, several years ago, although I am not a rich man, I turned down an offer of $1 million from a major New York publishing house to write a book about the JonBenet Ramsey murder case because, not being involved in the case as a lawyer or an investigator, I didn't feel I was in a position to write with any special insight and authority and the kind of true crime novel true crime book I try to write. The discussion of God, of course, is the most well-traveled terrain in the history of man, and therefore the majority of this book will necessarily address topics familiar to a well-versed reader. But if at the end of this book you didn't find several and hopefully many more fresh insights that cause you to say to yourself, hey, I never thought of this before, not only will I be surprised, but more importantly, I will feel I had no business letting trees be cut down to print this book. Another thing you should know about me is that I am an extremely critical person. Indeed, you have a difficult time finding someone as critical as I. I told Geraldo Rivera once, Geraldo, I'd find fault with a beautiful morning sunrise. However, I'm also a very complimentary person. Curiously, though, I'm not cynical, a trait so often associated with that of being critical. In fact, my late wonderful mother, the most feminine woman I've ever met in my life, and two sisters, one of whom is fortunately still living, although I was a naive, thought I was a naive person. I define cynicism as seeing yourself in other people, and for whatever reason, I don't see myself in other people. That said, at the first thing I see wrong, I criticize, rarely keeping my criticism to myself. Most of what I criticize in this book, in my opinion, flows from stupidity and or ignorance. As you know, the words stupid and ignorant are frequently used interchangeably, although they have quite different meanings. Everyone is ignorant about something in life, usually many things, I mean. If Einstein never played or knew anything about the game of chess, he'd be ignorant about chess. One could say that people can help it if they are stupid, or people can't help it if they are stupid, or to a lesser degree, ignorant. And if they can't help it, why get upset with them? Because stupidity and ignorance are not benign. They are responsible for much, if not most, of the great problems, misery, and injustice in this world. And when I see stupid or its frequent companion ignorance resulting in great suffering and loss of life, such as the ignorance of the American people in being so easily led into a terrible war against a nation, Iraq, that was in no way an imminent threat to the security of this country, I respond with very critical and sometimes harsh rhetoric. That's just the way I am. And among many other triggers that anger me are hypocrisy and incompetence, the latter being rampant in our society from the presidents on down. In fact, it's very frequently so bad that the only adjective in the dictionary I've been able to come up with that adequately describes it is staggering. It's so common that I expect it, and when I find competence, I am pleasantly surprised. I tell you these things because that what follows is an almost unremitting, scathing indictment of God, organized religion, atheism, and theism. And many people, being sensitive of nature, are offended by highly critical discourse. If you are that type, I admire your civility, but this book may not be for you. As you read this book, I would ask you to join me in this journey of mine to try to make sense of the religious and theological arguments and beliefs that I wrestle with all along the way. I say wrestle with because if there is a God, he has chosen to keep those he created in the dark about him. So we all are handicapped, mentally handcuffed in our desire to understand the mystery of life. If, as you read, I offend your sensibilities in any way, I apologize sincerely to you in advance. If there is something I write that you feel is an error, or I miss an important point you feel I should have made, I would certainly like to hear from you. Voltaire tells us that common sense is not that common. Though in one way this is true, it is nonetheless linguistically contradictory. That is, if common sense is not common, from whence does the term common sense come from? And may we define common sense, then, as that which, once stated, is recognized by all reasonable people as being rational and sound judgment. I feel I will have succeeded in this book if you, the reader, or for the most part, don't raise your eyebrows and wonder how I can strongly state on one page an argument that goes in the direction of supporting a belief in God, and on the very next page set forth an argument that goes precisely in the opposite direction. In other words, you could say to yourself, this author is contradicting himself. If you don't reach that point, it probably means that you are being swept along by what I hope is the uniform thread of common sense in my evaluation of the evidence, my only master on the question of God. First chapter starts off with two quotes. And this first chapter is called God, Etc. There ain't no answer. There ain't going to be any answer. There never has been an answer. And that's the answer. Gertrude Stein. And the next one is from one of my heroes in the Bible, Job. It says, can you understand the mysteries surrounding God? They are higher than the heavens and deeper than the nether world. So what can you do when you know so little and these mysteries outreach the earth and the ocean? Since the dawn of recorded time, human beings throughout the world have looked to the heavens to help in their daily lives and eternal life after death. These people who sought the intervention of an invisible being with supernatural powers eventually became known as theists, those who believe in God. And two other, much smaller groups emerged, atheists, who believed no such being greater than man exists, and agnostics, who scratched their heads and took no position. Although in the vernacular, agnostics are those whose position is, I don't know whether God exists, neither believing nor disbelieving in a deity It is thought that the better definition of an agnostic is one who believes that the evidence versus non-existence of God is unknowable. Of course, it is unknowable. One can't know. From an historical perspective, the word agnostic is of relatively recent origin, but the date of the word's first usage by its creator, British biologist Thomas Huxley, is not clear. In his 1889 essay, Agnosticism, Huxley speaks of the word agnostic coming into his head as the arithmetic to the antithetic to the Gnostic of church history. Huxley goes on to say that he used the term at the earliest opportunity he had before the English Metaphysical Society, of which he was a member, but he doesn't say when that was. However, on January 1870, article Pope Huxley, published in the British magazine Spectator, referred to Huxley as a severe agnostic. So his appearance before the Metaphysical Society had to have been before January 1870. Most historians settling on the year 1869. So that's how the word agnostic came around. Of course, there's always been Gnostics who, you know, are believers, but the agnostics are those who are don't believe either way. In other words, there's not enough evidence or logical evidence to point to the rationale of these religions or the statements or the faith that people have, or the, you know, the kind of extremes that people go to in defense of their religion or their faith. And it's having been in this position, having understood atheism, having been an atheist for a short period of time, and I had all the questions that the author here, Bugliosi, I had asked all those questions at one time or another. I've studied metaphysics for about 35 years or so, and ever since I was a teenager, question my existence, basically, or God, you know, the existence of God, and justice, and cosmic laws, and I searched many, many different religions, from, you know, Buddhism to shamanism to, you know, Christianity and all of its different forms, and as well as Islam, and so many great writers, like, for instance, the great mystic Rumi, who invented the dervish dance, and the whirling dervishes, you know, and his wonderful poetry and his wonderful mysticism that so embraces the blessed emotional rhapsody, if you will, or rapture, not rhapsody, rapture, that comes with the total absorption of a belief in God into your system, into your mind, and your heart, your soul. And once you have experienced in some method, some way, that remarkable presence, all right, or that remarkable overwhelming presence, okay, in your life, it's impossible to describe the joy think the argument for faith, for belief in God, has ever really been logically expressed or adequately expressed. Therefore, Mr. Bogliosi's arguments are more and more invalid, for sure, and his attack against the absurdity of these organized religions, or even the absurdity of the concept of faith. If you go by strictly an intellectual assessment, okay, of faith. But having read so many, and we've read all of these so much on this show, I've read so many selections, so many different works, from Agni Yoga to Ralph Emerson to Thoreau to God, the lectures of Manly P. Hall, Ethan Fromm, Eric Fromm's, rather, Eric Fromm's Anatomy of Self-Destructiveness, fascinating book, which I've read a number of segments from over the last year, actually. And we trying to understand the motivations for people's actions, watching them and observing them, and then writing about them, or writing about others who have observed and evaluated these things, and we've come to that summation, and Mr. Bugliosi's book is actually that. He quotes all of them, or not all of them, but I mean much of them, and he breaks apart the different houses of cards, you know, that are built upon these fictitious myths. You know, these myths that are created in order to to define the essence of God or the essence of a higher intellect, okay, than our own, through personification. The people do this continually, and you know, it's talked about in Vincent's book. He talks about this as well, how we have a tendency of mankind to create metaphors, you know, for things that we don't understand, you know, and create words or concepts that aren't logical or not in logical current understanding. So what may have very well been clear in the Greek or Latin or Hebrew versions have been retranslated and have been redefined, okay, in interpretations. And so to believe that the sacred texts are, and Mr. Bugliosi goes into this very deeply, but to believe in that any of these texts were legitimately written by those that it was presumed to have written them was false. And it's known. It's known by the religious communities that... that the disciples of Christ did not write the Gospels. In fact, most of them were illiterate. But that how these got to us in these parables and these stories and so on, were from oral tradition. And that's understandable since the early Christians were persecuted for nearly 300 years. So, you know, nothing was kept in writing unless it was extremely secret. But yet, you know, disciples went out and preached these things and taught these things. Just as Socrates at Plato and Christ had Paul, you know, and so on. These are all hearsay. It's all hearsay evidence. It's all hearsay, you know. There's no specific reality to that. So it can be torn apart. And Mr. Bugliosi does a very good job at that as a prosecutor. It's mine going in and tearing apart these different religions and these different concepts. But my only real disagreement with his premise is that he is, in attempting to unravel the obvious, the argument which does that, dismantles the myths, what it does as well is it neglects the perhaps it neglects the appreciation, and that may be the wrong word, but the appreciation for the great man of faith, who trans, excuse me, great men of faith and principle who have transformed society in the world with its ideas and with philosophy and our religion. They've created, they've given the world such great concepts, such great understanding, but the world in turn didn't understand it. That's hysterical. That's ridiculous, actually, how it sounds. But, I mean, people hated what Christ said to the extent that they killed him, right? Publicly executed him for going against this. Mr. Bugliosi would probably, if he ever wrote a book like this in, you know, even 50 years ago, he would have been tarred and feathered, you know, by the Christian community, and he may still be. However, I found, as I read this book, and I did read this book, that as I progressed through it and met all of his arguments, I met each one with a strange resistance that I can't fully understand. The knowing of the unknown, and I've talked about this when on the Toltec path, when we discussed, when I read Ken Eaglefeather's work on the Toltec path, and several weeks ago, and I've discussed this many times during this program as well. But the Toltec concepts, but the most important parallel to draw to that and this work is that the Eaglefeather's dimensions, the ability of man to achieve unlimited potential in his, as himself physically or as spiritually, and it showed the multiple dimensions of man's own character. So if I could draw a parallel between that work and say his Bugliosi's criticisms of all religions, I think that these shamanic, basically, religions, and that one was sorcery, but not not in the sense that Don Juan and Castaneda were involved with it so much, because they transcended that element of the Toltec way or the Toltec path, and brought it to a greater height of personal enlightenment, fulfillment, and into the extent of transcendence, and they could virtually disappear before you. They were able to conquer the natural and spiritual natures in their merging and their ability to create their themselves to a higher vibratory rate, so that above the, you know, into dissipating their body, you know, into completely dissipating and then reforming it again through thought. These concepts are so mind-boggling, and these works have been done and researched by many who are followers of those faiths, that just to blow them off in an irrational, or I should say irrational, but to blow them off in some seemingly rational argument is, without understanding the mystical history behind it, the mysticism behind it, is unfortunate, because that element, that essential element of knowing the unknown, the experiencing, the having the emotional fortitude, regardless of what the intellect says, the emotional knowing, emotional knowledge, the inner knowledge, okay, that, say, God exists, is impossible to explain, and that's why it hasn't been adequately explained since the beginning, right? Only that it's something that needs no explanation, because it's so overwhelmingly present in your life. And I can clarify that, and then I'd like to go on with this book, but I wanted to clarify that statement since I've read this book, and I like this book, extremely like this book, because it really touches on all of the superficial arguments that man has woven together regarding God over these years, including theists and atheists, and to the point that any rationally logical person would say, yes, there is a major question, and whether God exists, I don't know. But every person will say, one or the other, I don't know, but I feel this way, or I do know, and it doesn't matter to me what's said. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of like Galileo, knowing the world was round and knowing all the planets were round and being able to see it through a telescope and being told that he was crazy, the earth was flat, okay? This was the only way to think. That Aristotle was the only genius in this, in science, you know. And he said this, so this is the way it is. Well, Aristotelian thinking was great for a primitive who had no computers, who had no instruments of measurement. I mean, they couldn't measure the stars. They couldn't. You know, I mean, you got to remember, in Aristotle's time, they still believed that the stars represented gods. You know. So to go by that account made very little sense. So when a scientist like Galileo, or a thinker like Galileo, discovered a telescope and was able to see these visions, did you see them, right? And then he brought them forth to the public. He was censored. He was censored. And he was, you know, held captive by the Pope and imprisoned. I mean, he was held prisoner in his own home. So, and it took several hundred years before the world said, well, yeah, hey, you know, it's right, the world isn't flat. And that big church took a big slap in the face on that, right? And changed their ideas around. They had to, because people already knew that the church was bogus. That's why during the 15th century, you had the Protestant Reformation, and people started saying, this is nuts, you know? You know, everything is too trite, you know, and other knowledge of people that sailed the earth, the Vikings and the early Masons and so on, they brought back maps, they brought back reports, and so others sailed forward, like Columbus, you know, Magellan and so on. So, essentially, I guess what I'm saying is that for every critic of society, or every critic of conventional wisdom, will always be criticized, will always be ignored, will always be marginalized, okay, until that theory, his facts are eventually recognized, people recognize them. And I think if you read Bugliosi's book, The Divinity of Doubt, it recognizes the fallacies. It recognizes the irrational concepts, okay, throughout the ages of God, its relationship to man and the earth and so on. And in doing that, in bringing these arguments specifically to the reader's attention, and drawing the conclusions that Bugliosi draws, one has to believe that there is or is not God. But that definitive commitment of believing or not believing strictly becomes a matter of faith, which we understand as a totally irrational way to think. But faith is strictly based upon an emotional gut feeling, right, that you're right, okay, of the rightness of your thinking, right, that you have faith in yourself, or you have faith in your decisions, you have faith in your that they're going to work. And you know this is true because you're going to back it up, you know, or it's all backed up by prediction and by facts and figures. You've seen it. You've made a plan. You've seen it happen. So somebody once mentioned, and I forget who wrote this, but we human beings operate in patterns, okay? We see patterns. And once those patterns become unraveled, okay, it throws us into a great chaos, okay, and that's why people cling to these absurd concepts. because it has created a pattern, a motif, a way of thinking. That's why you're a Democrat or a Republican. You think in one way, and they have you thinking in this way. And so, you know, you don't really have to think too hard for yourself, all right? As an agnostic, you got to pretty much think for yourself because you're saying, Jesus, I don't believe this and I don't believe that. But as a devout believer, you're one of two types. You're one who has either questioned the existence of God and his relationship with mankind to the extent that that Vincent Bugliosi has, but further than that, even in the sense that you have practiced different pagan religions, or you have studied them, or you have mastered certain principles of comprehension of these remarkable ancient religions, until you became into the religions of the current, the known Christian and Quran, the dogmas, the dogmatic religions. Okay? These are the ones that have corrupted the concept of God, okay, if you will. The association with God, the association with nature, man's association with the universe. What is our connection? These are the quintessential element questions to ask. What is our connection to the world? What is our connection to the universe? What is our connection to infinity? What is our connection? Since we can imagine infinity, then infinity must then exist, right? Because whatever we can imagine can exist, or does exist. If not in this dimension, in an alternate dimension, okay? And for us to deny, since science has already identified up to 13 other dimensions, which I think Mr. Bugliosi even mentions in his book here, there actually is, according to other metaphysicians, upwards up to 144 different dimensions, all right, of existence. And each one is, the reason there's 144 levels is because each level has its own overtones. Okay, so, and this is talked about in many of the different sacred texts as well, the concepts of the auras or the altered states that people achieve through religious experience. I can't. The rapture of the mystics, the rapture of the saints, the ecstasy, if you will, the emotional, physical, and intellectual ecstasy, all right, of a mystic's love for God. Is there's nothing like it on earth, because there's nothing, it's impossible to explain that without being open to misunderstanding, because without that connection, it's impossible to explain the existence of God. It is impossible for anyone to defend God. It is impossible for anyone to defend it. Well, how can you defend anyone as a prosecutor, not a prosecutor, as a defense lawyer, if you cannot understand the crime, if you do not understand the nature of the individual, how his judgment was either impaired or enlightened, how he or she questions something or embraces something, what does that do? Why, why do they embrace that? And my feeling, and my understanding of it, is it's not really something that you can anticipate. It's not something that you can prepare for. It's something that is either with you, inherently so, or it's not. There are many people who believe in God and many people who don't. And those who don't have the same valid reasons that as those who do. And that's what Mr. Bugliosi has tried to say and has so well portrayed in his book. Both rational and irrational arguments, okay, to the same question. Does God exist? And though it's impossible, and I know this because I've tried and I've read others who've tried and I've read works, how do you rationally and emphatically or empathetically describe death to someone? All right? Describe it as death. Simple death. There's no life beyond that. There's no hope beyond life. There's no life beyond death. All right? And for us to imagine that, it's so devastating to the human spirit that it so violates all that we are as human beings, that it denies us the access to the cosmic forces that are continually showering down upon us and helping us and gaining, just as the sun and the rain fall on us, so do the blessings, I believe, or the knowledge of the cosmos, the knowledge of nature. And we all operate, we are over 90% water, our bodies, our minds, whatever all that we are. And water is the most essential element to life. Right. And life, how do we explain this? How do we rationally explain this? And because Bugliosi talks about this in his book, you know, how can we get to a drop of water, all right? A random drop of water, all right, is what we're made of, what we are. So as an atheist, we're no more valuable than a individual drop of water or grain of sand. And it's fascinating too that those who look at life from an atheistic point of view, people like Stalin and people like Lenin and people like Trotsky and people like Marx and Hegel and so on, these people see only one thing, and that's power. Power is God. And in order to, and power over others is God. You know, so in order to you funnel that energy into God, into the state, into the government, then people all work for the government. They all love the government is the top thing. The government is their God. All right. Then what you're doing is you're transferring all of that radical energy that's going to God, okay, worshiping God, all right, to worshiping the state, all right, and that's done through what? Those who do not agree get eliminated. Those who do agree remain alive. That's why 22 million people were murdered in massacred under and imprisoned and so on under the rule of Stalin and during the World War II and how they could so heartlessly kill or starve or destroy so many people under these atheist regimes. Look at communism under China under Mao. He was responsible for killing 25 million people. In order to enforce his rule on the Chinese people, and keeping them enslaved and keeping them chained to devotion to the state, otherwise they'd be killed. These are the trademarks, if you will, of atheists, but at the same time, atheist governments, atheist leaders. But at the same time, if you look at these fundamental religious leaders and the Catholic Church and so on, these people are responsible for the deaths of millions and millions and millions and possibly billions of lives over the centuries in insane religious wars. I'm right and you're wrong, that kind of thing. So what I'm getting at is that in his wonderful work, and I highly recommend everybody get a copy of Divinity of Doubt by Vincent Bugliosi, but if it doesn't make you question your belief, then, like he said in the book, it's not for you. If you get insulted, because he's insulted people, he insults people in this book, calls them insane, stupid, ignorant, but he tells you why he's saying that, and asks you to prove to him any differently, right? And I found myself laughing through this book in quite a number of places. His arguments were very, very, very poignant and very affronting, calling you down for your foolish beliefs. But yet he doesn't knock you out because he says, hey, I understand why you believe this, and I understand, but I don't understand why you still believe this. Ignorance is the major reason why most people believe in these religions, in the major dogmatic religions, because they don't have to think, but they refuse to look or even read the texts. Okay, a lot of people haven't even read the Bible who believe and say the Bible is the sacred word of God. But I guess where I'm going with this, I'm almost running out of time. But I guess where I wanted to go is I wanted to emphatically ask my listeners to please get a copy of this book. It's on Amazon.com. It's called The Divinity of God, and it's by Vincent Bugliosi. All right, and for those of you who Bugliosi, Vincent, and just a wonderful read, and for anyone who is a theologian or anyone interested in the metaphysical arts, then I suggest that you definitely encourage you to read this book, because it will either shatter your faith or strengthen it tenfold. And for that, I appreciate Mr. Bugliosi's work. And it's a book that you want to pick up and read again, and you want to continue to read, because it's great fun. And just don't take it, as an affront to you, but only as an affront to your intellect. Because those who believe by faith alone. That's what faith is, and nobody can understand it, and that's why it's called metaphysics. So it's things that exist but that cannot be explained. And that's my job on Thursday nights, try to explain it to people. So I want to thank everybody for joining me, and please join me tomorrow night when we have our good friend George Nixon on, and maybe I'll be talking to him about agnosticism. And because George, in his own way, has said the same thing, you know. And we've talked about these issues time and again, but the only difference is that we brought in the existence of the higher intellect, not so much God, but as a more recognizable character in the Anunnaki, as more advanced civilizations, and we continue to talk about that, that have brought knowledge and genetic engineering and so on and so forth to the human race. And we are now at a period where we're rising, and I think that evolving into something greater. And I think that's why I believe that this book is so important to the seekers of our generation, of our time. And I believe it answers a lot of questions and raises a lot of questions that have to be raised and answers that have to be answered. And with that, I'm going to wish you good night. And please join us tomorrow night, Lila and myself and George Dixon, right here at 8 o'clock. Okay. Let's see if I can play out with my old music here. Here we go. Good night. Disconnected from my internet. All right, and once again, I'm going to try to end this show with a song. Good night, and talk to you tomorrow. Jeez. All right, well, I can't play out tonight, so I want to thank everybody for joining me, and have a pleasant evening.